thanks so much for coming to the last once-a-long seminar event for this academic year. Very happy to have our wonderful panel members to be at this meeting with the, to discuss the topic of art festivals and the city. My name is Hyun Bang Shin. I'll be chairing the event today as a member of the Urban Salon, the team. Urban Salon is a fairly informal organization, interdisciplinary, based in London, but actually the scope of the discussion goes way beyond London, obviously. We have been having quite a few events on an irregular basis. I guess almost all of you who are here have seen the website and know what the Urban Salon is about anyways. I won't go into explaining about the organization. But if you haven't actually signed up to receive our regular updates, do go to the website at the www.theurbansalon.org. And there will be an option to sign up for our mailing list. There will be more events to come, but as I was saying, this is the last event of this academic year. There will be more to come in the coming academic year, so do please watch out. Other than myself, other members include Dr. David Poch, who is here at the front, from King's College London. We also have Jenny Robinson from UCL, Matthew Gandhi from Cambridge, Loretta Lees at Leicester, and Monica Degen at Brunel University. We do take our turns to organize these events, and thankfully it's my turn to actually take this organize this event and chair this one, a very exciting one today. The event was actually conceptualized with the great contribution from Julia Run, who is here, who is going to introduce the topic to the audience today. But essentially, our discussion today will be starting with the introduction by Julia Run, after which we'll have contributions from our four panel members, who are not in the same order as what the event description says, but we follow this order, I guess. So we'll start with Cecile Boone-Ferrer, who is sitting in the middle. She is based in London since September 2013, and she's curator and advisor for public and private structures, and most recently been invited as curator of Douala Sud, 2017 triennial in Douala, Cameroon. But actually, Sud, that stands for like Urban Salon.
Salon Urbain de Douala.
Urban Salon of Douala. So it's actually quite nice to have you in this Urban Salon event. Next, we have Andrew Harris at the far left, who is senior lecturer at the Department of Geography at the UCL, and he's also the co-director of the UCL Urban Laboratory, which has also a number of interesting events. And UCL Urban Laboratory has been also a very good supporter, strong supporter of Urban Salon, and has been disseminating our event news very widely. So it's very nice to have Andrew Harris with us today. His research has been on the role of culture and the visual art in urban regeneration strategies, with expertise in London and Mumbai. And we have Dr. Adam Kassa, who is right here on my left, who is from the School of Architecture, Royal College of Art, and who is also the co-founder of Teatrum Mundi. I hope I get the pronunciation correct. He completed his PhD at the LSE, so it's very nice to have Adam back to LSE. I hope he's pleased to be back as well.
Of course.
And he's currently a research fellow in the School of Architecture at Royal College of Art. And his research has been including the critical and urban theory to consider public space, the post-colonial and negotiations of capital in late modernity as they touch ground in the practices of architecture. Last but not least, we have Professor Andy Pratt over there, the last person. Professor of Cultural Geography at the Department of Sociology, City University of London. And Andy also has been, used to be with LSE in the same department as mine, Department of Geography and Environment at the LSE, before moving to King's College and now at City University of London. London. So Andy has been a worldwide expert, renowned expert on cultural studies, cultural geography, and well, it's essentially very nice, really nice to have Andy back to LSE as well. And I hope, again, he's happy to be back.
Absolutely.
To LSE. Finally, our first speaker, who is going to introduce our topic to the audience, Julie has also the experience of being at LSE before moving to Humboldt University in Berlin, where she did her PhD previously. She used to stay with the Department of Geography and Environment at the LSE as LSE Fellow, and her research has been largely looking at the comparative urbanism, urban theory, and cultural production through research at the intersection of artistic practices and cities of the majority world. And her previous research has been including the comparative understanding of art spaces in Berlin and Beijing. So, and I guess the latest project is also to do with the relationship between art festivals and the city, which is the very topic of our discussion today. So I think without further ado, I hand over to Julie for the introduction. So.
Thank you. I'll sit here. thanks for the introduction. Thank you, everyone, for coming. So I wanted to just briefly introduce this topic kind of generally and also share some of my initial thoughts from field research that I'm currently doing on this topic of art festivals and the city. So there has been a proliferation of art biennials, of art fairs, especially in the past 20 years, and especially in cities outside of Europe and North America. Contemporary art events are everywhere. And here's a map from the Biennial Foundation, so just biennials around the world. And of course, there's not an even distribution, but we can see it's reached all kinds of cities all around the world. And even if you see that yellow dot in the middle in the south, the middle of nothing, that's the Biennial of Antarctica. So the question for me is why? Right? Why do all these places and cities care about contemporary art? What is the significance for these kinds of events for the places that they inhabit? And so the purpose of today's event is to look at this relationship between the art festival on the one hand, so the art festival, the world that it inhabits, its resources, the attendant values that come with that, its institutions of authority, the actors involved, so the art festival on the one hand, and its event hosts, right? The cities and places where it's situated. And they come, of course, with their own interests and politics and actors and institutions. So what is this relationship? Is it mutually beneficial? It can certainly be very fraught. So I thought as a provocation today, we could start perhaps with the discussion about Documenta last year, Documenta 14. So Documenta is an art festival that's held every 5 years. It's considered widely, I think, one of the most influential art festivals in the world. And last year, they featured a satellite event in Athens. It was an excursion abroad from where they normally hold the event, which is in Kassel, which is a mid-sized, unassuming town in the middle of Germany. And it's been held there since 1955. So last year was the first year that they did it somewhere else. They opened first in Athens before they opened in Kassel. And this excursion abroad raised a fair amount of criticism. So Yanis Varoufakis, former Minister of Finance, called it crisis tourism. It, of course, didn't seem great that Germany, imposing austerity measures on Greece, was now also imposing this festival, turning Athens into a kind of spectacle. It seemed like a way, to some people, for them to exploit the political and financial situation in Athens for cultural consumption. The curator, Adam Sinchik, had this tagline for the event called Learning from Athens. And that seemed just a little patronizing to some people, to put it very generously. Another issue was the distribution of resources. So it was way over budget, the event. In September last year, New York Times ran an article called Why a World Famous Art Exhibition Needed a Government Bailout. And to quote the article, called Learning from Athens, Documenta 14 appears to have practiced what its title preached, at least in terms of relying on bailouts. So they had a more than 6 million euro deficit at the end of the event. It ended up jeopardizing the event itself, in a way. So it led to the firing of Documenta's CEO. There are multiple petitions from artists about concerns that the Documenta board is now just going to focus on the event being profit-oriented. It only cared about budgets anymore. There was a huge political debate that it turned into about curatorial freedom. This is all exacerbated by the elections that happened at the same time and by the fact that the city of Kassel and the state of Hesse, both board members of Documenta, had to step in with loan guarantees, right? So it was a public debate around the resources being used by Documenta. People also criticized the degree to which Athens-based artists and art institutions were involved at all. Adam Simchik noted in a radio interview, quote, naturally, you could accuse us of not getting involved with the local art scene, but we weren't interested in the art scene in Athens, rather more in the city as a dynamic organism. And that transcends contemporary art. Athens doesn't stand alone, but represents other places in this world. Lagos, Guatemala City, those occupy us here equally. The demand to connect us with Athens' art scene would be too small for this Documenta. Our exhibition never wanted to represent the Athens art scene, unquote. So you might understand that a lot of this raised a fair amount of confusion. How does this position reconcile with his tagline of learning from Athens if you don't care to involve the Athens art scene? Another issue was that a lot of people in Athens simply had no idea that this was taking place at all. They had about 330,000 visitors to the Documenta in Athens. That sounds like a lot. And then you compare it to the more than 850,000 visitors that they had in Kassel. And to remember that Kassel is about a third of the size of Athens. This implicated that perhaps it was, you know, the artists from Nigeria and the visitors from London that were attending the Documenta in Athens, but perhaps really very few people from Greece. And all of this pointed to a very uncomfortable insider-outsider dynamic, right? Even the economists weighed in, asking connoisseurs or colonists. So this excursion abroad to Athens was roundly criticized for its voyeurism, for its non-engagement, for the way that it was implemented, for the show that it was, and for the longer-term consequences for this festival itself. So this is one way to think about art festivals in the city. But then there are also works like this. This is from the artist Rashid Araim, called Food for Thought. It took place under canopies that are inspired by the Shamiana. It's a Pakistani traditional wedding tent. And people were invited there to have a free meal on a public square on Qadsiya Square. Here's another work. This is quite a contrast. This is at the Athens Conservatoire, the Odeon, and it's a work by Emeka Okbo called The Way Earthly Things Are Going. It's a multi-channel sound installation with a traditional song from Epirus, Greece called When I Forget, I'm Glad, and a real-time LED display of world stock indexes. So I don't come from an art background. I didn't study art history. I don't have the language vocabulary for a lot of this. What's interesting to me about looking at these works is to think about what it represents in these places. How does it represent contemporaneity, and what does that mean? How is it embodied in the selection of artists, the selection of artworks, and to think beyond perhaps the structure of the event, there seems to be a function of contemporary art for the urban imaginary. So how could we, for example, imagine a different kind of encounter on the agora? Rethink public space, rethink the demos. Or how can it offer an alternative perspective on the Greek crisis when interpreted from a sound artist based in Lagos? It is about dealing with what is happening right now, in this time, in this place, about a certain kind of contemporaneity, and perhaps also through it, a kind of idea about a future. So what do we imagine the city to be? And to borrow Abdou-Malik Simone's work, you know, how does the city yet to come look like? The city yet to come. In staging these events, what are the kinds of imaginaries, narratives being heralded about these places, about this moment? So my research right now takes a comparative perspective looking at the contemporary art biennials in Dakar and Taipei. I just got back from Dakar this weekend, so the biennial just opened 2 weeks ago, so it's very fresh in my head, and it's very preliminary thoughts, but since this is an informal discussion setting, I thought I would share some kind of preliminary thoughts about this. And one is to really think about the significance of contemporary art in place, and about its multiplicities of meanings. So at one of the side conferences at the Sheikh Anta Diop University, Simon Gighandi, who is a comparative literature scholar at Princeton, he was a keynote speaker, and he highlighted the potential of contemporary art to disrupt the prison house of radical difference, the way that African art is what he called locked in a European episteme. And he saw the Dakar Biennial and its focus on contemporary African art as a provocation to question traditionalism, to question points of origin, to question its own representation, and really marked by its refusal to be located in a museum. The event and the art that's being shown there, in contrast to a museum institution, represent something that has not yet been acquired. It's not yet been codified in a canon, and it's not yet one a cultural production that is being placed in a past. It is happening right now. So it seems that contemporary art serves to locate place in a specific temporality. Right? Dakar is happening right now. And Dakar is now is also, this idea kind of joins in with a lot of urban critiques that are happening around developmentalism, and what Jenny Robinson and others kind of point out about certain places being locked into a trajectory of never catching up in their development to other places, catching up to some idea of a modernity, a modernity that actually defines itself against the non-modern, right, against these places that are never going to be modern. So that's perhaps what sets the art event apart from other events. So Kuhn's work and a lot of geographers look at things like mega events in the city, right? They have an enormous impact on infrastructure, on social displacement, on investments and divestments. And I want to contend that what makes art events particularly noteworthy is not just its economic impact, so not just about tourism or its accompanying kind of issues of voyeurism or exploitation or public financing or institutional politics, but really, and that is all really important, but I think what sets it apart is this notion of contemporaneity. Right? Why the Contemporary Art Festival? In that this contemporaneity, it dislocates these cities from the presumed categories of development and situates them in a new time and place. So I have several more thoughts from Dakar, but I think I would let the other panelists also maybe speak. And I'm quite curious about, from all their various different positions they're coming from, how they read the art festival and the city. So I had some discussion questions around, how do you assess the risk of exploitation and the danger of crisis crisis tourism. What is the impact of aspirational politics on these art festivals and on these cities, aspiring to be some other place? How do you evaluate the role of contemporary art in this? Like, what about the specificity of this kind of event in contrast to other kinds of events? So I would hand off to Cecile.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for being here. Thank you for inviting me, Julie. I hope I'm going to be clear enough because, of course, English is not my first language. As a curator that has been involved in different countries, actually, and different geographies, Julie's introduction is really helping me to actually focus on this project we did last year in December in Douala in Cameroon. So this is the fourth edition of the Triennale in Douala. And as for some of you, you might not be familiar with where is Cameroon. It's located just in the middle of the continent. It's a huge city. That city doubles itself every 10 years. And 65% of the population is under 25. It's based on the sea, and it's really like the heart of the economy of the country. As you might well know, it has been colonized by the Portuguese, as much as the Germans, British, and French. This city has a fantastic dynamic, and this is probably what has been as well the interest of our project. Sud means Salon Urbain de Douala. Sorry for the French, but it seems that it's still very present in that country. As you might know, French and English are taught at school, but at least 153 languages exist in Cameroon. They're still taught. The previous edition of the Sud have concentrated their production on public project only, mainly. Most of these projects are outdoor projects that half of them, I would say, would benefit to its population. Here we have a piece that has been done in 2010, which was dedicating, it seems, to the notion of water. This area had an old fountain that was not accessible to the people that have, as you can imagine, no water and no electricity. So part of that project was to combine a fountain as much as a theater. This theater is still operational, and we use it for any kind of important event. Douala Art is the initiator of the Sud. It's one of the first art centers in Africa and has always orientated its production and its project in town and outdoor project. They do propose the themes and choose its curator to coordinate, and then we coordinate and produce the projects. So the different themes have been, as you can read, about very much about the town, about the water, about the transformation of the city. And 4 years ago, they approached me and they asked me to work on the idea of human rights, but I'm not a specialist on human rights. And because this country has been run by a president for the last 35 years, you can imagine that the level of corruption is so high that we had to find another way of dealing with those issues. Therefore, we choose the theme of the human dimension. Why? Because in those places, even walking the street is an issue. Even just, you know, making your rights, your basic rights, is so important and crucial. So how to make a festival, a project with those issues, without, as you say, Julie, not being patronizing? That's a big issue. So Douar L'Art has been extremely interesting for me because they have really worked on the whole town, really all along the estuary and in very different areas. You have to imagine that within that city, the airport is just, you know, we land in the city itself. So the city has a kind of a mix, a fusion of industrial site as much as what we would call favelas type of residences, as much as a center that is very highly protected. So this festival, as Marilyn Douala-Belle puts it, because she's the director of this art center, it aims to develop peaceful relationships among the citizens, respect of public spaces, and put into the light its remnants of patrimony, because some buildings are still from 1910, from the German colonies, and they're trying to keep those traces. And this has been the work of Douar L'Art for the last 20 years, as much as educational propositions and innovative, I would say, site-specific projects like the one we have just seen of the fountain. So, as a white, half-French, half-German person, how could I possibly do such a project and assume it? This was for me the main question from the beginning. So therefore, I choose as method to set up a committee of different people that are acting locally and that are extremely involved in history, as much as lawyers, ONG, educators, artists, anthropologists, and clinicians. A study of 1 year study of or one of our anthropologists has brought to light that a person of 16 years old does not even know its basic rights, because we're talking about at least 150 years of amnesia, forced amnesia of their own identity and own story. It's extremely complex to therefore set up projects like as we would do it in a white cube or a Western country. Myself, I've been working museums, I've been working in also in white cubes, and it is true my challenge in that project was to consider myself really as someone that is a bit like kind of working like an architect. You have to know where the light comes from, where the danger is. You have to have all that knowledge. And myself on my own, I could possibly not have that possibility to understand all this. So really, it was a teamwork. And we really worked with the artists. They came three times. Most of them came three times to see the space, to make propositions, to work among themselves, because many of them had some experiences of public projects and some of them did not at all. So we try to mutualize our knowledge. We try to work as well among ourselves, because authorities, the government with whom Dual Art is working since more than 25 years, is just starting to understand possibility, actually, I would say, culture can bring to them. So it's a one-on-one, I would say, relationship, but it's about negotiation. It's about negotiating every tiny project of any tiny space, because public space in Douala is always taken by, you know, a little corner shop or someone that wants to start a business. So it's extremely complex to be able to choose this eventual space in the city and to be able to make a proposal. On the other side, it is true that we don't have all these norms and all this kind of constraint that we will have here. So there is always this possibilities in which you have to find your way. And what can an artist bring in such a story? What can a narration? What can we do in all this? So each artist has been, you know, developing different kind of projects. But basically, we've been working with existing network, as I said earlier, and existing institutions that have a very strong, I would say, program with people from outside coming to their school and opening their eyes on history, on law. And we did, during 2 years and a half, a lot of small workshops with the students to let them know about their own story. So artists have been involved in this. And we had as well, therefore, 16 artists that have been invited from an 11 from the continent. As a result, we had 22 artworks that had been produced. And we also made a symposium of a platform in which, for 3 days during the festival, people could find information, interact, and have the possibility of speaking of our topic, which was the human dimension. So basically, this was a bit like the scheme, you know, with which I was working. And basically, all the artists have been chosen according to their skills, some topics. So Ivan Argote, who is from Colombia, has chosen to work on the drains, because, as you can imagine, in the city, the drains are outside, right? They're not under the, they're not covered. So because it is a tropical country, you can imagine when you walk what that means. And with the rains. So he has decided to work with, actually, the government. This was a huge collaboration on how to pave these drains. All over the city, he's been making a huge poem, because on each little, cement blocks, there are some words related to dignity, to love, to respect, all these words that here you can maybe hardly see, but that have been inserted on the cement. This is a huge work. 3 million of inhabitants. This has taken us 3 weeks. He has been working with 12 people, 12 technicians, nonstop. Another artist, Hervé Yamgen, has been invited to work in elementary school. And as you might, anyway, in a traditional belief, you give a children space, you give him his own space in life from the moment you allow him to sit on a chair. If you don't give a chair to a child in a family, you don't give him a space. So he decided to invent these little chairs in the courtyard of the elementary school. And he based these chairs out of a workshop he did with the kids related to, therefore, human rights symbols that he's been articulating with the kids. Yep. Okay. I'm going to be fast. Mustafa Akrim, another artist from Morocco, has been working on a technical as well college on the first article of the Human Rights Declaration, making it bilingual, because that notion of lingual, of speech is extremely important in Douala and very sensible. Chourou Kriesh, as well French, but from Morocco, she's been costumizing motorcycling riders that have a very bad reputation in Douala, and she made a whole, I would say, défilé for us. There were 80 people. She did as well other projects with the kids related to the city itself, and this is a mural painting that exists now in a school on 400 panels in the city. There was a video of 20 seconds in these panels with someone writing, typing the article at different motions. So this was a very important and interesting piece, because it was really infiltrating the city itself in all its different places. We organized a football match between different teams, between the artists and local teams, and it was also very interesting and very moving. This was that very moment where it's an art piece that actually connects one article as well of human rights together in bilingual, in French and in English. At that moment, we made this as a performative piece that was finalized on the wall. Other kind of pieces, I have plenty others. What is important related to our topic is that for each pieces, for each inauguration, there was a huge performances, intervention of the kids, of the people who have been involved in the project, sometime as well of the sponsors to whom we could give a speech or give them the possibility of expressing themselves related to the project. Half of the project are still, you know, in the city. This is as well another project related to the fact that most of the people that speak Cam Franglais, which is a fusion of French and English, they are not reading it all the time. So we decided to make this project, Hervé Yumbi decided to make all the articles of the declaration in Cam Franglais in the city. This is a big piece of Eric Gunkrich that is actually a fantastic square that allows people to meet each other. This is a fixed piece that is going to stay. Well, anyway, each time there was a very, I would say, joyful moment for each introduction and for each inauguration. Here you have a piece by Pascal Martin Tailloux, under which there was a lancement, how do you say, when you throw balloons with some articles and words out of the articles of human rights. So we have been with this project, to sum it up, trying to first aim, trying to to reach a quality of relationship first with the citizens, because this is the result of 3 years projects that have been introduced by people locally. Although many of the artists came from South Africa or Colombia, wherever, my curatorial responsibility was to make sure that they would invest themselves in the topic in order to make propositions that would make sense to the context in which I have been invited and committed to work for. So this is the way I work. There's more images, but I don't think we have time to go any further. What interests me in this project is the capacity that this project and that Dual Art has to involve people in the community and in the projects. So this is the way I work. It's an enormous, I would say, involvement. I like doing that, and I have been doing that in Congo, in Taiwan as well, in different places. Thank you.
Thank you. We move to Andrew Harris. Would you like to stay here?
I'll sit down. Okay, thanks very much, Yun. Thanks, Julie, as well, for organising this very interesting event. I just want to start with a quick confession, really, which is that I don't think I've been to very many art festivals at all. I've certainly not been to many of these biennials that have sprung up, it seems, in every part of the planet. I haven't been to any Documentas or any of their satellites. I haven't been to Venice Biennale. I haven't even been to any of the Frieze art fairs that happen in my home city. So I was thinking about this, actually. I was thinking why this is. And I think perhaps it does have something to do with the economic and cultural capital I've accrued as an urban geographer. I think also it's probably more to do with the fact that I haven't actually done much direct research on this topic for quite a while. And as we've seen, actually, it's been fairly recently that we've seen this proliferation of these art festivals. Obviously, there's some longer, more historic ones as well. To a certain extent, I think also I'm slightly conscious that often with work on art and the creative city more generally, there can be, I think, a bit of a sort of hazy line between the people involved and the critical infrastructure that surrounds it as well. So that's, I think, does play on my mind from time to time. But what I want to do today is to throw into the mix a couple of quick case studies of urban art festivals. And I have been to at least one of these. And this is from PhD work that I took in London and Mumbai back in the early 2000s. So hopefully this travel through time and across a couple of continents might be helpful to assess some thinking, I think, prior to the current era of high-profile urban art jamborees. So I think both of these actually precede a lot of the kind of proliferation that Julie referred to. Also, these relatively small-scale, semi-professional art festivals I hope can offer potentially a contrasting yet connected slant to these more recent initiatives. So first off, let's go not very far at all, up to Hoxton in this city. This is a place actually that Andy, as well as myself, has studied. Now, obviously, I assume a lot of you will know Hoxton. It's a well-known, trendy neighbourhood, but it hasn't always been the case, and certainly in the early 1990s, it wasn't. And in fact, really the only sorts of people that were living there, wanted to live there at the time, were artists, living kind of semi-legally in the area's many kind of abandoned industrial spaces of this period. And this attracted one particular gentleman called Joshua Compston, a very charismatic cultural impresario who set up the area's first gallery on Charlotte Road in 1992. And he organised a series of conceptual art festivals between 1993 and 1995. He very much took advantage of the fact that this area seems perhaps bewildering now, but at the time the area was virtually deserted, and he rented out stalls for a nominal sum to artists, many of whom lived and worked locally. So he staged his first festival outside his gallery in July 1993, which he dubbed the Fate Worse Than Death. Highlights of this fate, attended by approximately 100 people, included Gavin Turk using a piece of industrial tubing and a sock to run a Bash a Rat game, and Damien Hirst, dressed as a clown, you can see him here on your left, making some of his first trademark spin paintings before exposing his genitals for an added 50p a time. I think it's fair to say there was no scientific committee that went into devising that particular artwork. Following the success of this first event, Constant held another much larger Fate Worse Than Death, attended by 4,000 people the following summer, and a further extravaganza he called the Hanging Picnic in July 1995, on both occasions using Hoxton Square rather than the narrow streets of Charlotte Road. Now, these for Compston were what he called an open-air art exhibition, a curated picnic, and a manipulation of the social real. Now, I think it's important to add that combining music, food, and a wide range of entertainment, they very much mined an East End working-class tradition for street parties and revelry. As Compston himself stated on being asked about these festivals, and he said, "What I want to achieve is more in tune with the life of working class communities 100 years ago." So quickly, what broader points can we perhaps take from this particular case of art festivals and the city? Well, first, this, I'd argue, was a way of activating the neighbourhood for new post-industrial uses. Compston's outdoor events worked, in his words, as a way of, and I quote, "shaping and mythologising the area and promoting it as a funky, upbeat, up-and-coming cultural zone." The area received considerable media coverage off the back of these fates or festivals, working as a calling card for many artists who subsequently have gone on to become very successful. And I think the apparent cachet of the area that it now has, I think, can be traced in some ways back to this particular period and the role of these sorts of festivals. And it's not disconnected that this artistic rebranding of this down-at-heel part of London through summer festival events was a process that received direct support from local property interests and also from local regeneration bodies. Secondly, I think it's important to note that these festivals, they may have been in some ways about the local non-artistic residential community, but they weren't more or less by or for them. Although they were specifically designed as an interchange between high arts and Hoxton's local community, the attendance and participation was largely drawn from friends and acquaintances of the artists involved. So I think what, you know, potentially we might want to point out here is there is a, I think in this self-conscious artistic revelling in a disinvested urban landscape, we can see, I think, some kind of connections with what Julie was talking about in relation to the role of documenta, or certainly one interpretation, obviously, of the role of documenta and its recent foray into Athens. Okay, now somewhere different. This is Kalagoda. This is in Mumbai in India. This occupies a prominent position in downtown Mumbai, at the southern end of the Fort District. Now, Kalagoda means black horse. This refers to a large black equestrian statue you can see there of Prince Edward, which was erected in 1876. It was then taken down in 1965 and joined a number of other colonial statues, including a decapitated Queen Victoria, in the grounds of Bombay Zoo, where it remains to this day. Now, the Kalagoda Association was established in 1998 as a citizens group concerned about the impact a new surge of construction in Mumbai was having on the city's older built forms, and particularly its older colonial architecture. And one member of this particular association, Rahul Mehrotra, who actually is an affiliate of LSE Cities, came up with the idea of focusing on Kalagoda's concentration of art galleries, pavement galleries and other cultural institutions to give the area more of a personality. The association successfully petitioned the city authorities to designate the area as an art district, and the festival has become an important part of asserting this status, generating what Morocha calls cultural significance for the area and forming the basis for launching a program of physical improvements. Now, the association have also looked to draw on the diversity of Mumbai's contemporary urban life in the festival through what they call temporal happenings, such as pavement galleries and outdoor festival events. They have aimed to provide what they call a contemporary engine that can sustain and broaden the conservation process, transforming Kala Gowda into a site of active participation and change rather than simply a static, what they call, urban museum. Okay, so two quick sort of snippets of case studies across London and Mumbai of urban art festivals. Now, in some ways, this obviously sets against a kind of backdrop of neo-Gothic colonial architecture involving eminent architects like Rahul Mehrotra, and a lot of the people that organise this event actually are wives of Indian industrialists. It's quite removed in some ways maybe from Hoxton and the kind of wacky games of the young British artists in de-industrial Hoxton. But I think there are actually some interesting commonalities between these two examples. So Kala Gowda, like Hoxton, I think the festival here has helped reanimate a declining area of the central city. It has developed awareness and funds to help conserve the architectural heritage of this precinct. In the process, it has played very much into asserting a particular image of the city. The Kala Gowda Art Festival has been created, promoted, and utilised by many of the city's upper middle classes to cater to their aspirations for spaces and practices of transnational urban life. And also, like Compston's events in Hoxton, in Kala Gowda, although efforts have been made to conceive this area as a living entity, the temporal happenings of the festival have largely been enacted in relation to the area's built forms and historic cultural legacy. By turning the buildings and cultural institutions inside out, many of the festival events and performances have purposefully acted to disregard and distract from the everyday life of the area's outdoor public spaces. So in some ways, like Douala, it's a city with a lot of hustle and bustle. But I think, unlike it seems a lot of the festival there, it hasn't really sort of accommodated or worked with the kind of public civic life that is very present on the streets of Mumbai. And actually, efforts have been made to actively exclude some of these so-called informal users of Kala Gowda. In the 2006 festival, street children were allowed to take part in a craft demonstration but were pointedly shooed away with sticks by security guards during the dance performances. So I think despite these gestures to local context and history, it seems both these examples of urban festivals can be understood to provide an artistic gloss to post-industrial London and to post-industrial Mumbai in a way, I think, that serves to further accentuate social and cultural divides in these two cities. Now, I think it would be churlish for me not to recognise and in some ways praise the levels of enjoyment, interaction and playfulness generated by these sorts of festival spaces. But I think I want to signal the need for further self-reflexive and critical consideration of how these cases, at least, align in and with the surrounding urban fabric. That's it. Thanks.
Thank you very much. Okay, without further ado, we move to Adam Hassan.
Well, hi everyone. My name's Adam, and I am a researcher and tutor at the Royal College of Art. And it's a real pleasure to be here, so thanks, Julie, for inviting me, and Hyun for chairing. My background, I think, similar to Andrew, isn't specifically to do with art festivals and the city in a direct way, either as curator, like Cecile, or as researcher, like Julie. but as someone who thinks more broadly about the relationship of culture in the city. And I'm reflecting about what to share with you today. There's one project I've been involved in with the Venice Biennale for the last six, seven years, which has been an invitation by a local group there called We Are Here Venice, led by Jane DeMosto, who is a local campaign group to try to remind people that this is a living city, a city with various degrees of poverty, varied degrees of unemployment, and a dwindling population. So it's a city of great wealth and privilege, of kind of rabid swells of population, something in the realm of 40 million tourists a year in a city of 30,000. And at the same time, that city is often not seen. And so this project that we were working on with her and with many other colleagues was became phrased around this notion of culture beyond tourism. And I think at the heart of it was trying to think around this relationship between cultural production in the city and cultural consumption and the various levels of optics that are involved in it. And I'm already reflecting on the examples that Cecile brought, which actually invert that or are really careful and critical reflections about production and consumption in the city and its relationship to infrastructure. So this is just a brief outline of the project. It was looking at Venice as a kind of canary in a broader global circuit of cultural-led tourism and trying to think in broad scalar numbers, like in Spain, for example, that has over 60 million visitors a year for a country that only has 48 million. So it has a third more people coming into the country as tourists than it does as population. So what does that mean in terms of the spaces, in terms of the cities? And more specifically, in a city like Venice, there's a huge juxtaposition that gets raised between the quote-unquote cruise ship visitors who come in and unload at the realm at the rate of 30,000 a day or 60,000 a day versus the kind of Biennale visitors and tourists. And so there is embedded in the kind of flows of cultural tourism a real imbalance and something around questions of the circulations of those elitisms and the questions of to whom the problem gets, who's called a problem. So a cruise ship tourist is called a problem, the Biennale tourist, maybe not so much, and yet the ways in which those things flow into each other I think is interesting and worth focusing on. So we held a kind of symposium in 2012 and 2014 and 2016 at the Architecture Biennales. We worked with Liza and with local activists and colleagues to try to give voice in a different way and allow them to leverage us as a kind of international institution. We were at the LSE at the time to try to give some presence to their concerns. In one example, we actually invited them, with the Biennale, we were invited to host the Finissage in 2012. And as part of the ending kind of discussions, we actually convinced them to allow a kind of community-led meeting about the future of the Arsenale to come in and act as a kind of community meeting inside the Biennale, which hadn't been done before. So Jane DeMosto is the lead of that. And so for me, what I'm interested in thinking about today, and these are just slides from their website, because it's really their work that is provoking some of the thoughts I'm having today, is around both the question of, and I'll get into this at the end, the language of consumption and production as the only kind of language that gets deployed. So, for example, in the work I was doing at Teatro Mundi, the project was trying to revert or reassert the role of cultural production as a space to think about in terms of policy, in terms of finance, in terms of urban regeneration over spaces of iconic consumption or spectacle or display. And yet even that move keeps culture within this realm of production and consumption, which is only one way or one vector of looking at the relationship. The other is to think about different moves that are in line with what Jane's doing, in a sense, of trying to recover a sense of localism, managing tourism, thinking about local environments, reducing the cruise ships. which is about a kind of relocalization or remunicipalism. And I think that there's a very interesting relationship around the notion of the last 20 years of explosions of global biennales at the same time as conversations about, at least in large tourist spaces, a remunicipalization or relocalization of their economies. And so one example that came out in our symposium in Venice was from Zaida Mushi, who's a researcher and architect in Barcelona. And with Barcelona en Comú, the new government there, there's a process of remunicipalization around things like water, housing, electricity, so bringing the civic back into civic control. And one of the quasi-provocative policies that they brought into the council was a new system of zoning for hotels. So to try to actually de-densify their tourist infrastructure as an active measurement to control that in the city. So zone one, for example, which is the heaviest part of the hotel zone, there can never be any new hotels. So only if a hotel closes or space closes, it can't be kind of rezoned as a hotel. In zone two, you can have an equal maintenance. So if one closes, you can have another one open, but only with the same amount of beds. Zone three, you can have... zone three is kind of, I think, like a... have certain kind of growth, and zone four is like intensive, they actively want to draw tourists. And in a sense, what's really interesting about it is it's not a kind of a closed-door policy, but one that tries to understand the relationship of tourist flows on local spaces in the city, and to try to think about active ways of de-densifying and diversifying where those things happen. I was interested to see in Douala the kind of de-densification of activity, let's say, in one space, and how that plays out. But I guess my thinking is two cases. One I've already mentioned, the language of cultural consumption and production. Is that the only way that we can think about or understand the processes that are at play? And I think Julie's already mentioned or brought out some other indices around other forms of meaning or meaning-making that contemporary art might have in spaces and cities, both locally and more broadly. And the second is something around a reaction against spaces of tourism that I've been thinking of in relation to what Jane DeMostro has taught us in Venice, in terms of this kind of a retrenchment or a relocalization or a divestment from global flows, and how that tarries with broader political moves at the moment. And I guess thinking about that in the explosion of global art biennales. So how these two things, a kind of explosion and a retrenchment, are happening at the same time. So end of that. Thanks.
Thank you very much. Okay, we move to our final speaker, Andy.
Hi, thank you. Well, I've not got a PowerPoint, that'll just be me. What I want to talk about is, in a sense, many of the things that that people have pointed to and say and said we're not doing that. What I want to look at is the whole Biennale movement, in a sense, not the movement, but many of the activities in associating with that. The issue, in a sense, of the elite art world, and how it is so dislocated from everything that we've seen, how it doesn't engage with cities and doesn't engage with places. I'm interested, as a sometime cultural economist, for actually how it works, why it works, why it happens in this way. Trying to understand, in a sense, rather than what most of my other work has done, has looked at people struggling on the ground, is this is the elite in the cyberspace or in the business class sort of world that circulates the world which runs the art world. What I want to say to start off with is that the relationship between cities and the biennales, I guess the sort of conclusion and thread running through this is that it's a dysfunctional relationship and it's usually a damaging relationship. But many of the actors involved don't seem aware of that. So, for example, the way that the Biennales are set up invariably is at the invitation of a major city that wants to attract some publicity, basically. They want to reboot their image of the city. And therefore, this is a city branding exercise. Yeah, and so, really, they're not really interested in the impact it has on the citizens of the city. They're only interested in what other people outside the city think that it will change the reputation of the city. And of course, you know, we can have lots of discussion about how superficial that view is, etc. But it's an instantiation of a particular perspective here of city managers and city brand managers and mayors, etc. And this sort of debate that is encouraged by the notion of the city of cultural consumption, which is that cities are competing against one another and our competing city has this event, therefore we must have something better in some way. So that happens. As much as we may critique it and say how silly it is, nearly every city that you go to, you talk to their mayoral office and they're right in it and they want to do it. Yeah, so we need to understand it in some way. And so partly, of course, understanding all of that stuff about cities and culture and the way that culture is instrumentalized, etc., all that is sort of background here. Take that as read to an extent. The other thing to look at is actually what... So there's the cities saying, we want an art fair or we want some other mega event. And then there's the events themselves. So one of the things that I've been interested in developing over the past few years is looking at the organisation and growth of the Biennale movement and why there are these contemporary art fairs all over the place and what they do and how they're organised that way. So that's sort of partly what is really interesting there is that we're seeing various means for... bringing to ground temporarily a global market in contemporary art and bringing buyers and sellers together for a period of time where they can have a good time in expensive hotels and you know, fly in and fly out and have very little interaction in some way. And this construction of a number of biennales is also about the maintenance of a particular construction of the contemporary art market, which is manifest, as we see, in particularly in the auction rooms of London and of New York particularly. But these are ways in which artists get visibility. I mean, one of the things they used to say about art is they're not making it anymore. Whereas contemporary art, they are. And there are arguments saying they're making too much of it and it's affecting values. But so the issue here is the reputation economy, is how you manage your exposure in some way. And part of these art fairs is about the way that certain pieces, in a sense, come to show at market or come to come on the agenda. So there's a whole set of activities going on there about this circulation of income. And I'll say another dimension of this circulation of art. In the ordinary world, we have passport controls and we have trade barriers and all that sort of stuff. The art world deals with paintings that, particularly in the contemporary art world, paintings that will be several multiples of the cost of a jumbo jet or a 757, 767 or whatever, you know. So these are you know, hundreds of millions of pounds. Yeah. So not surprisingly, many of the issues involved in contemporary art is about subverting national boundaries. And they've even created institutions in this. So there is a thing called the Freeport in the art world. Well, basically, this is a building that sits aside an airport and basically allows you to bring an artwork into a country but not be in the country. And so you can see your artwork there, but it never officially enters the country, and it can move off to another country if you you want to go and view the art there or whatever. So this is Yves Bouvier, was the first one that developed this in Luxembourg, but there have been many multiples of this. But it tells you something about this value circulating, signified by painting. I mean, I'm not interested at the moment in anything about what these paintings represent, what is on the canvas or whatever. They're objects that are circulating, that are signifiers of value, and they are real value, money in the bank, for this group of people, in a way. So the cities then become places to show off and reputation build, to get a welcome, and also, in some of them, to locate these free ports. So I just want to give you a couple of examples, one from Southeast Asia and one from the Middle East. So the Southeast Asia example is that we're talking about Hong Kong. And Art Basel has just set up an offshoot there. Art Basel is one of the groups of international art fairs, and Art Basel was attracted, Hong Kong attracted Art Basel to be an outpost, to be part of the inner group, in a sense. Yeah. So this was Hong Kong saying, we're better than Singapore, basically. So the Art Basel there really has very little connection to the city. When I was there last time, it was a part of, as at the time of the Umbrella Revolution, and really there was no connection between them. Although, despite, of course, the fantastic artistic engagement of those people participating in the Umbrella Revolution, that's another issue. But the complete separation of these is actually part of the issue, to an extent. That's part of what they are. They're sanitized, enclosed spaces, which are only the few invited are able to come in and participate. Part of the reason that I started doing this work was that I managed to get a guest ticket to one of these events, and I was so blown away by this sort of other world that I'd not experienced, that I thought it might be worth looking a bit more closely at how it was operated. So the Hong Kong case, that was a classic case of a city trying to boost its growth through the attraction of one of these events. It signifies, of course, great wealth. It signifies being part of the movers and shakers. And this is all the thing for city brand managers. This is great. You know, this is tick, tick, tick. It's got all the things we want, yeah? Or they think they want, in that way. What's interesting in the Hong Kong case there is that, of course, Hong Kong's struggling with developing its own art gallery. Yeah? The West Kowloon development and the M Plus Gallery has been through years and years of trying to get things going. I think it may have just opened or just about to open, or certainly not fully functioning in this way. But of course, that itself is a further example of an international contemporary art gallery that isn't about Hong Kong. Yeah? It's just a showcase, in a way. And what's interesting is there's an internal debate in Hong Kong, particularly with the Asia Art Archive and many of the other galleries and spaces, talking about is it possible to have an Asian contemporary art? Yeah? And what would that look like? And how would we curate that? And how would we look after that? And so clearly, Art Basel is not part of that. Interestingly enough, the contrast is with Singapore, the great rival in terms of city branding of Hong Kong. And maybe because Hong Kong had Art Basel, Singapore set up their own fine art fair. But interestingly enough, they had focused very much on the local area. So particularly the development of Indonesian contemporary art was a great focus for this area. So it wasn't an international art fair. It was one focusing on the local region, particularly interesting. But Singapore isn't getting to get off scot-free, because Singapore is one of the locations of the Yves Bouvier free ports. And I was fortunate enough to have access to this bizarre institution. It was just like a James Bond film in terms of the security measures and everything going in. And it's the most boring sort of unpleasing space. It's basically like a prison there, and basically it's a series of different cells which people put their artworks in, and then they can go and bring their friends along to look at them and then go away again. It's a very sad life. Or they can move it to their an equivalent location in New York or in Amsterdam or something. So, but of course, paying no tax is the key thing. And there's a whole big question here about this is a way of potentially recirculating all sorts of untold laundered money, drugs, guns, everything around the world, because this is a free space. Basically, so art has become linked to many of these other informal networks and ways of circulating huge amounts of money around the world. So that's another big story lurking below this. But you see the linkages. So, would you want to attract art fair to your city? I wonder. So maybe there's another side to this for the city mayors. What are they attracting? Quickly to flip over to the Middle East, where, of course, we've seen lots of examples of attempts to link city branding to fine art. And I think particularly we see the examples of Abu Dhabi. We've seen the Louvre offshoot opening there. And again, I think we see, although there's a little bit of a balance in there, we see once again an example of a global museum with very little attachment or connection with its local area. I mean, there have been attempts, and there are attempts to curate activities that do have connection with place, and the building itself, of course, tries to make that connection. But again, I think we have this issue where clearly the location of Abu Dhabi in terms of the international air traffic, the airports in that region were all built to basically monopolize on the breaking of travel between there and the Far East. So the idea is to focus on consumption, but also focus on a little bit of art tourism as well whilst you're passing through passing on. Of course, the final dimension of that is, to have a contrast there, is with Qatar. Qatar has prospects for developing all sorts of... there is another huge art gallery about to be built there at the moment. Located also in this huge education complex, which is one of the largest sort of so-called education workspaces in the world. There's lots of expatriate universities from various parts of the world have located in this cluster of universities, this knowledge district in Qatar. And the key thing here for the art world part of this is that the Qatari royal family are stupendously rich, and they are collecting art. And there's a huge purchasing going on, it's been going on for the past 5 or 6 years, collating a huge amount of prestige artworks. So I think we will see the gallery completed and some content put in there. Again, to display, rather strangely, a reflection of an international Western perspective on contemporary art rather than one about the local contemporary art. But I guess my point is here is actually, to an extent, that doesn't matter because that's the game that they're not in. They're in talking about global reputation and global reflected position in relation to money and income. So, basically, with those little snapshots, what I wanted to show is like another side of the relationship between cities and art and culture. And these are parts of the art world and the cultural world that actually don't want to connect with the local, aside from using them as a pivot point to move money or move resources around the world. And therefore, there is this sort of mutual relationship between some of the cities who are seeking to attract this activity. They attract the activity, they don't really attract any economic activity there. It's simply this sort of reputational side of it. But that we have this whole blooming business of the art trade, art free ports, and these Biennale events that seem to be quite a booming area of economic activity and international trade at this point. So I'll leave it there. Thank you.
Can I invite all the speakers to come to the front and so they can have the Q&As and discussions?
Yeah, water in the middle.
Yes, beautiful. So thanks so much again to our five speakers for making this talk very concise and also very enlightening. A number of keywords come to my mind. I'm not going to summarize what has been already talked about, but if you can think of the title of the event tonight, Art Festivals and the City, and then one thing that comes to my mind is I think people, or each one of us sitting in this room, will have our own understanding of what art festivals are, what kind of city we are in this season, and you know, different types of art festivals each one of us will be kind of thinking about while listening to these talks. So one person may think of very, you know, a very grand and a luxurious art festival, whereas some other people will talk more about kind of smaller scale, neighbor-based kind of festivals promoted by local residents. So there's kind of a wide spectrum of art festivals you can think of. There's also the question of whose city, the usual question of whose city we are referring to, especially involving these citizens and different types of residents and who are from the local areas and who are from elsewhere, and how these art festivals and the organizers behind the art festivals are speaking to these different types of citizens. So there are kind of questions of the kind of keywords that were in the blog for this event today. The aspiration of politics, whose city, whose aspiration we are referring to, and which all kind of come down to different ways of imagining the city and the art festivals. And I guess also the selection of agendas and values which were hinted and pointed out very frequently throughout the talks tonight, and how these values and whose values are being captured, the economic values and cultural values and political values being all part of the whole pictures. So it's a very complicated story, and it'll be useful for the next half an hour to have questions from the audience. Do raise your hand. We'll get maybe two or three questions at the same time. Make your questions short. Try not to lecture tonight. Make it short, and also maybe speak up a little bit since we have the recording which subject to technical we're subject to not having any technical problem. If we are hoping that the event will be saved and recorded and disseminated as podcast. So please do speak. We don't have the roving mic for tonight, so this is the only equipment that you can see. So do speak up as much as you can, if you are, especially from the sitting behind the back. Right, so questions. There are already five going on. We'll start from that end, so maybe pick up three questions, one from the far end, sitting next. Are you sure? Right, we'll start with the, I think there was one.
Yes.
And we'll take another one. Dear Murray? Yes.
My question is based on, and your intervention, to all of us, I guess. So I think the question of, what biennial...
Oh, actually, can I ask who you are?
University of Warwick. The question of what's the purpose and function of biennials for the locality is a very important one. But I'm wondering if local responsibility, especially in non-Western context, is a bit maybe misplaced, as in maybe there's an inherent orientalism in not recognizing the local contribution of contemporary artists who comply with the Western tradition. So are we expecting a little bit of more, a Palestinian artist talking about violence and suffering constantly? And if it complies too much with our expectations of Western aesthetics, are we actually not seeing it as a local language? But I don't know if it made any sense. I just think we reached at a point where the world and all these festivals are global enough that, yes, they do share genres of biennials, festival organization, etc. But there is a much more refined contribution of, for example, Istanbul Biennial is, still complying to the Western tradition and yet having a very fine-tuned engagement with the politics of the city.
Next, Marik.
I also have a question for Andy. It's a similar question. I'm just curious about, in your experience, for the people involved, what underlies the presumption that local culture production has nothing to offer this branding exercise?
So this is from Maury from UCL Geography. then there was one, Jiajing. Okay, where you have the mic.
I'm Jan van Duppen from the Open University, and I have a question for Cecile. Thank you very much for a great presentation. I wonder how you understand the difference between development aid and the festival that you organize, and maybe in particular with the example of the covering the drains, and how you see the long-term impact of art festivals. And maybe you can say something about the financing of your festival and how that also shapes what you are able to do.
I think given that some questions are directed at particular speakers and some are more kind of general questions, maybe we get just one more and let the speakers respond to whichever one they would like.
So my question now,
could you introduce yourself?
My name is Sajid. I'm Alice's student. My question is to the past two speakers. So I'm wondering, based on my experience in the Venice Biennale, I was wondering whether it's the inherent nature of the Biennale, which is an international art festival, inviting different artists from different countries to showcase their best artwork. So I'm wondering if the nature kind of defies the point that they can do some contribution to the local community, because they come from very different backgrounds. Maybe their work are of some social impact, but it's specific to their own country or the city, not necessarily to Venice itself or to in general.
Okay, I guess we can invite our speakers to respond to questions, specific questions directed to you, and also to other questions.
Shall I make a start then?
Yeah.
I mean, I was not trying to make a conclusive point about all biennales. I mean, I think the point is very clearly that there are a number of circuits of biennales, some that are very sort of the elite globalized ones, and some that have more local content and local engagement in there. And I think there's a issue there about clearly in terms of the main participants, or the participants that they hope to get to buy this stuff. I mean, it's an incredibly elitist organization, because not everybody has several million pounds to invest in a piece of work of art. So in that sense, it is inevitably, and therefore it is inevitably, I think, relatively disconnected from much of the city life in that way. Now, clearly, there are attempts made to make those connections. But coming back to the third point to partly answer that, I think there's a whole issue, surely, about the notion of the Biennale is a modernist intervention. It's a modernist intervention about a particular type of culture that is assumed to be international and internationalized, and therefore defines what the international is, and the modernist tradition being one of promoting modernism in this way, and a break with tradition in that way. So it's already defining out many of the things. And in fact, don't forget, modernism was defined against regionalism and localism. So it's not part of the picture of being a modernist to adapt to the local. It was the whole tradition is against that. So I think to expect, in some ways, the Biennale movement to connect with the local is a sort of category mistake in a way. Well, it doesn't mean, of course, that I share with you that, you know, you've got these spaceships landing. There should be some connection between local people and what's going on. But I think there is a sense in which it's a lens, a system of viewing the world that is actually quite antithetical to there being a significance of the local that shouldn't be repressed. And that's where it comes from. So that's partly about the beast that we're talking about, and maybe we're thinking of ways of trying to sort of tame it in some way.
Cecile, maybe next?
Yeah, okay. In answer to your question about this eventual confusion I might have related to... intervention of artists within the city. Unfortunately, I haven't shown everything. I think I'm pretty aware of what eventual design in a city could bring to a city and an artwork. When we do project with artists, we submit it first to the citizen that are going to have it or to be in the proximity. I'm extremely cautious of to whom I'm addressing myself when I commission artists. And to the contrary to what Andy was saying, I'm extremely careful because I have been very much experienced in the art world since a long time I'm working. And I know very well what Andy might have explained or kind of reduced as well to a very, I would say, stereotype. But I think artists are able and artists have a voice that us as curator, we have to give that possibility to give that enlightenment, I would say, to a city or to a place or to a museum or wherever. And I believe so. And then it requests an extreme attention. It requests really a lot of work. It does not happen like that. And here we can be very critical of Biennale and so on, but I think some of my colleagues work very well, and not all the Biennales are very, very posh, and I think it's not so easy. Now, related to your question of finance, your question is extremely important because it questions the ethic of the art world, and it is true, for example, in this project, some people were saying, oh, but you should just knock at the door of Bolloré. You know Bolloré. Bolloré is like the person that owes Africa. To give you an example, in the length of 4 years in Douala, he has built a wall of 12 kilometers long, 5 meters high, in front of the sea, so that he has the monopoly of all the business of the sea. So this is this kind of person. And some people say to us, well, just knock at his door and eventually he will be super happy to finance your project. And of course we would never even touch this. So when it comes to finance art, it's a very, very important question because you have to have an ethic who you are approaching to do these projects. What is the aim and what for? And therefore, this project was supported, I would say, yes, three quarters was from outside of Africa, but also one third, and I'm very, very proud of that, to say that this was local companies, Cameroonian entrepreneurs, that put money on the table. And this is huge. This is absolutely huge. And the second thing that is super important is Douala, this art center, succeeded this with this edition to have a kind of an agreement with a pool of, I would say, local companies that would back them up for the next Biennale. So this is extremely important symbolically as well.
Are there any other speakers?
Yeah, I would maybe go back to my slides for a minute. To address your question about like the local and global, I think the division is a lot more complicated. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to show through an example. So this is the work from an artist named Christian Liampeta. He is a Rwandan artist who grew up in the Netherlands, who produced this work for the Kalandia Festival in Palestine. And it's a work that's considering life after life and what might happen if you woke up in the wrong afterlife. And what he uses as excerpts from a Senegalese film that's called Kelvar, which is from the early 90s, that's largely in Wolof, which is the local language there. So we have these interesting moments in Dakar, which is a Pan-African festival, so it is international, but it's focused on art of the continent and the African diaspora. We have these really interesting moments about the language of local or global that gets really complicated, right? So you see in the inner picture, there is French subtitles, which is the original Senegalese production because they're speaking in Wolof. And below, you have Arabic because it was first shown in Kalandia in Palestine, and then English for the bigger audience in actually both Palestine and in Dakar. And what he was saying was, you know, for him, like, he didn't produce this with a view of showing it in Dakar. Like, he was invited to show it in Dakar because they'd heard of this. So he was producing it for this other festival. And so he was really nervous about showing it in a Senegalese context where people actually all knew this film. And he said for him, one of the more rewarding moments was this moment when the production staff, when they were setting up, came in because they heard Wolof, which is not a language of that you heard in a lot of the video art that was being shown. So there was a moment of recognition. Right, so that says a few things, right? One, it says that the language of local and global is a lot more complicated. But the second is also that it is an exclusive space in which the local vernacular is not commonly spoken. He also complicates this idea of local-global in so many different ways as an artist, as a person, right? So he is of Rwandan heritage, so he fits into the diaspora as a qualifying characteristic to participate in Dakar. But he was raised in the Netherlands, and this work was produced with the funding from the Mondrian Foundation. So thinking about like the resources for this. And he's educated here in London at St. Joseph Martin's and at Goldsmiths. So like you were saying, you know, the language of the art, right? What language is he speaking? It's a lot more complicated than, you know, specifically where it's from, where it's produced, what is the language, right? It's also like how he was educated, the references that are being used. And and so I think that there are a lot of moments when we look at the things that are being produced and how it's being produced and its kind of trajectory, that those divisions are less clear. And the issue around accessibility is also, I think, less clear. So part of the Dakar Biennial is actually an off festival. So there is a big biennial, which is in a former Ministry of Justice building and a museum building. And then there are 300 events that are organized throughout the city as part of this off festival. And for that, it's taking place in public spaces, in hotels, in tailor shops, in galleries, and all kinds of places. And anyone can apply to become an off place and they get a flag and they're on the map and they're an off place. And this year there were 300 of these places throughout Dakar and even on Gorée Island. So you can see Dakar in the background there. This is the island infamously known as part of the slave trade. And they had these public installations also there. And what does that do to a space is, I think, my question. Like, when you make these spaces accessible, it's interesting because they're seen, they're made visible. I think, like, to speak to Andrew's presentation about, like, the ways that, you know, this fun and this spectacle renders a place kind of accessible and people come there. There's an art student that I met there who said, you know, she wasn't so interested in the art, but she was really more interested in, like, finding all these places, like, getting this map to, like, take her to all these interesting places that she wouldn't otherwise go to. For her, that part of the festival was most interesting. So what are the risks in rendering all these spaces accessible and maybe to go back to... you, like, consumable, right, now it becomes a space of cultural consumption. And I'm wondering, like, what is at stake there? Who is the space for? And just one more addition. So the second week of the Dakar Biennial, after all of the grand openings and the president came and there was all of this celebration, the second week there was a very different crowd that was going there. And it was mostly groups and it was mostly school groups. And this is the experience that I had as well when I did the exploratory case research in South Korea and Gwangju. After the big spectacle, after the media is gone, after the president is finished, it's a lot of school groups that are going to these festivals. So it becomes, the audience of this becomes for somebody else. And what they're working on right now is figuring out if there is like a, if you can develop like some kind of pedagogy around this. Because, for example, when I was in South Korea, like, people were complaining about how arts funding was being cut in schools. And so the biennial was developing their own curriculum. So for all the school groups that would come in, they would develop a larger lesson around, you know, around learning about art.
Andrew, Adam, do you have some?
I think just to pick up on some of the presentations and also the questions that have been raised. I mean, I think just to support what Judy's put together, I mean, I think, you know, there really is a research agenda here about how we sort of try to sort of think about the, particularly the geographies of these art festivals, and particularly the biennial sort of model, because it seems that there's, I think Andy suggested, there's different sorts of circuits, there's different sorts of temporalities, there's different, obviously, sort of regional dynamics, there's some, you know, events that have this kind of national component, there's, you know, different sorts of templates, as I think it's become apparent between the different sort of presentations with different ethical sorts of dimensions, different understandings of sort of the local. So it really does, I think, open up important space for the sort of comparative work that obviously Julie's doing, but I think also, yeah, you know, even the sort of the sort of this elite world, it seems like it's still rooted in certain sorts of local context, certain sorts of regional dynamics that I think potentially are very interesting once you sort of drill down, especially if you do have the access. I think it's, you know, really interesting to think about the artists and the sort of praxis they might have in perhaps, you know, playing with some of these categories and ideas. And you know, undermining perhaps even some of this kind of slightly elite biennial world that's created. And obviously, I mean, I think one thing that came out of this was my examples weren't actually biennials really. I mean, they were annual festivals, but much smaller scales, Hyun pointed out. So again, there is that sort of non-biennial art festival world as well. So there's really a sort of a rich kind of ecosystem of kind of these art events, and I think, you know, it seems to be driving a lot of, you know, see, as Andy I think pointed out, it's very much the sort of the latest flavour of the month in a lot of sort of city thinking, but we don't perhaps know much about it. There's obviously a lot of kind of work that's done accompanying these events, but in terms of actually tracing some of the kind of routes, circuits, there isn't a huge amount.
What I do is, given the time remaining, which would allow us to have just one more round of, you know, collecting questions, I will allow Adam to respond first, you know, to give him a bit more, you know, space to speak. So can you collect a few more questions. I think I saw a few more hands previously. So I think we'll start with these three questions, one here, and one at the back. Could you also introduce yourself?
Joe Adam, and my work in ad practice as a town planner. And it's something on regeneration projects as a town planner. So on regeneration projects in cities often comes up about our intelligent incorporating, whether it's temporary or permanent all the way through. I think it was quite interesting what you were saying about branding, and also the art festivals and quotations for trying to get investment when the consumption goes, and how do you improve the local area. So just wondered whether the panel could express their opinion about the mayor in London who's designating creative quarters, and whether there's something of a benefit to the local, or whether that would contribute to future art festivals.
Okay.
Yes, I'm Junyi, I'm from City, taking a PhD at City. My question is for Cecilia. I'm very interested in the project you share, and particularly the part you mentioned that you involved a few local specialists to take part in the project. But I'm curious about what does that project really mean for local people? Is it just for they can participate in 1 or 2 days or artistic or cultural events and then that's gone? Probably they may concern more about the corruption or the equality of mobility or education, things like that. So I'm wondering what does that mean for local people?
Okay.
Hi, I'm Cecilia Rinaldi from Goldsmiths. Thank you all for exciting presentations. I was just wondering, thinking about the name of the very workshop, the seminar we're in, arts festivals and the city, and what role the city is given. Is it just the passive recipient? Is it the stage in which all these displays and events and spectacles of art are shown? And what happens when we start changing and playing with that proposition? If it's art festivals of the city, about the city, in the city, or with the city? So my question for anyone who wants to answer it from the panel would be, what do you think an art festival for the city should or might look like?
Any, maybe one more question? Maybe not. Well, should we start with Adam?
Yeah, sure. Those are really, really good questions. I really like the last one. I'll maybe try to say something. But first, just around the creative enterprise zones and the notion of culture and regeneration. This is a proposal by the current mayor's office in London to create something like zoning for creativity in the city. It's largely to do with kind of trying to think about rents and trying to think about productive spaces or venue spaces and closure. But it's really tricky in a sense because it's just out to tender. There's been a kind of pilot study in Tottenham of a creative enterprise zone in North London in Haringey. And there's now a tender for boroughs to bid to the mayor to tell them why a certain area in their borough should be creative enterprise zones. There's a very, as a concept, it might initially seem kind of interesting, but the history of zoning in terms of kind of where that boundary is, who kind of lobbies in terms of property, in terms of owners, in terms of all kinds of interests about where that is and what that means, I think brings into relief a pretty not great policy solution. I mean, you could imagine just actually putting a line around the entire M25 and saying, this is a creative enterprise zone. Or if you're worried about issues around kind of land value and housing, then might not just have that for people who are involved in the creative industries, but thinking about a larger, broader strategy for precarious workers across the board. So I think there's an interesting kind of rhetorical gesture towards marking culture as an important space, but I think the creative enterprise zone and also their government-backed mortgages for creatives is not the best way to go.
Yeah. Okay, given the time remaining, I may have to ask each speaker, I guess because of the nature of the questions, it would be nice to hear from every one of the remaining speakers, but using 1 minute each.
Shall I just follow up? So I've got some more about the enterprise zones things. Yeah, I mean, the one I've been looking at is the prospective one in Hackney Wick as well, which is yet another one. I mean, part of the issue about this is that, as far as I know, nobody has quite knows what a creative enterprise zone actually is. It's a great name and everything, and so there's a massive problem. But, I mean, the underlying point is that artists as a whole can't afford to live and work in London. And that seems to be the elephant in the room. What do you do about that? For a creative city that has no creatives, exaggerating, but that's the point, yeah? And so there's a big issue, I think, about the way that we allocate spaces and if it's only by market mechanism, etc., and why so many of the things like Hoxton and whatever, the regeneration schemes, where has basically been regeneration by the market. It's called gentrification. You know, that doesn't redistribute at all and doesn't make sure that existing people can actually have access to a place. That's where the problem is. And, you know, obviously, if you simply go by those rules of highest land value, then you'll just end up with a city like the City of London, bigger and bigger, that incidentally, the City of London has no public space.
And perhaps...
Well, only if you want to respond, but maybe
Very quickly to, I think this return to the title of this event, Art Festivals in the City. So, I mean, I think one quick comment is, maybe we need to think about more than just one city. We need to think, obviously, about, I think often these events sort of straddle more than just one particular urban location. Obviously, they're often sort of on the go, and certain works sort of move between more than one place and have artists that work between different parts of the world, and critics and creators who also sort of circulate around. So perhaps that it's a bit too static in some ways. In terms of the art component to it, I think I would be wary actually of sort of placing art on the kind of pedestal too much actually. I mean, I think I wouldn't want to differentiate too much between the sort of art event and other sorts of activities, events that take place in the city. I think it was interesting in Adam's presentation about the way that sort of art tourists somehow are treated differently to the kind of ordinary cruise ship people. And I think there is a sort of potential hierarchy that emerges that is problematic and then sort of feeds through maybe into some of the kind of creative enterprise zone thinking about sort of privileging certain sorts of creative practice beyond simply a kind of wider M25 understanding of cultural life. So, yeah, so just some vague thoughts.
Yeah. Two things. The first thing, that notion of branding is quite interesting with the experience of Manifesta, which is actually it's a biennale that happens every 2 years in different cities in Europe. Right now it's opening next week in Palermo, and it has been in Rotterdam, it has been in San Sebastian, in very different scales of cities. And I wouldn't say that it was always successful, but it is true. Because it was punctual, it forced as much politicians, as much as people working in the town hall to have a kind of one shot, which was very interesting for some of them. Like San Sebastian was very important after this event. Because Bilbao, you know, like, shattered them. So, because of the branding of Bilbao Guggenheim. So, it is true that it creates a dynamic that is not always completely negative. And it's very important to be aware of this. And there's another thing I wanted to say, is that there has been an analysis of the French Ministry of Culture that have come to the conclusion that actually the cultural industry in France brings more growth than automobile industry. So in a country like France, the consequences of tourism due to the industry is bringing more money in the country than the industry of automobile. So, of course, it's extremely unpopular to think that culture is such a huge income, but it is true in some countries. So I'm just saying this because this should be really considered as very attractive, I think, for town hall.
Okay. Julie, one minute.
I found this discussion really interesting because I felt my co-panelists had all very distinct, different perspectives on the topic. But I want to go to Cecile's question because I think that's really at the heart of this. What would an art festival for the city look like, which I think is a fascinating question. And I think it's, the city is not just a passive recipient. Like, it's never a passive recipient. I think oftentimes they're the initiators of these things are not just a host, but, you know, it is the Taipei Biennial, right, belongs to the city. So they're not just hosting it, but they're really, like, initiating it behind it. And like Andy said, oftentimes it's about, like, branding this place, right, with a festival. So an art festival for the city would be really different because it would force the city to think about itself in a way that I don't think it does through these festivals, like, not so directly. And I wonder, for example, about like, what it would mean in terms of longer term consequences beyond the event nature of this. So beyond the fact that this is like a temporary event party and then it's finished and it comes again, like, is there a lasting infrastructure that is created through this, like, this regularity, this kind of and like how that would be different than, say, you know, when the Olympics comes to town, and like Hyun's work has looked at like the massive impact that these kinds of events have on the city landscape. Like, could an art festival do something perhaps less damaging, but perhaps also like longer lasting in terms of like having some impact on the local cultural infrastructure? I'm not sure if it's I'm ambivalent about whether that is like a thing that we should want or not, because I think the experience thus far seems to indicate that there's a lot of things at stake that are not taken into account in the festivalization of cities.
Well, thank you very much. I guess that wraps up our discussion today. Many thanks again for coming to event today, despite this being postponed from February when it was meant to be hosted initially. So thanks so much for staying with us. The Urban Salon, as I was saying, together with the Department of Geography and Environment at the LSE, was very happy to host our distinguished panel members. And thanks again to Julie for initially suggesting and conceptualizing this event. And looking after all the operation and logistics as well, and working with me to make this happen. So thanks so much again, and coming all the way from Berlin to be here. And again, thanks very much to all the members of the audience. I hope everyone here has learned a lot from the talks today, and also a lot to think more about art festivals in comparison with other types of events and what actually these events may mean for the people, for the city, what kind of places that
I just wanted to say that to answer your question, we just published this. These are 80 projects that Douala has now definitely in its city. So you can look at it.
And there's a book entitled Public Art in Africa, just for the record.
Yeah.
So this is the last event of the Urban Salon. So as I said, please do have a regular visit to the website, www.theurbansalon.org, for more events to come in the coming academic year. So thank you so much.